Monuments to the old Confederacy are coming down around town. Place names could soon change too. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the push to change the name of another landmark, downtown Hemming Park. 549-2937 to let us know your thoughts about that. Then later, author and food lover Jeff Speer on his eating adventures around the world. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reported 97,291 total cases Sunday. That's an increase of nearly 4,000. The state now has 3,161 reported deaths. In our area, we have 4,250 reported COVID cases. That's a one-day increase of 270 and 110 deaths. Now, as Confederate monuments around Jacksonville start to come down, there's also a push to change the names of public places and schools. Jacksonville City Councilman Garrett Dennis has introduced a bill that would change the name of Hemming Park. Hemming was named after Civil War veteran Charles Hemming. He donated the Confederate Memorial to the state of Florida in 1898. City Council changed the name of the park from St. James Park to Hemming after that donation at the turn of the 20th century. Dennis is proposing, though, that the park be renamed after James Weldon Johnson. Johnson hailed from Jacksonville and was a leading civil rights figure and a star of the Harlem Renaissance. Lots to get into here about place name changes and some COVID and RNC news. We're pleased to welcome City Councilman Garrett Dennis back to the show. Councilman, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well, and thanks for joining us. And as we talk about recasting monuments and markers to the Confederacy, also the rising COVID numbers in Florida and our area, we want your calls. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open as well. Now, in a moment, Councilman, I'd like to ask you about your bill that would rename Hemming Park. But first, I want to get your response to a tweet you sent this morning regarding the spiking COVID cases around our area. You tweeted that people have serious concerns and reservations about COVID and the Republican National Convention worsening things here. Mayor Lenny Curry, you say, responds by gaslighting and blaming the media. You have long been a critic of Mayor Curry and his leadership, and you're continuing in that vein this morning. But before we get into the Hemming Park stuff, I want to ask you, what are you hearing from constituents about their concerns when it comes to COVID-19 as we are starting to see more cases in the state? Once again.
Thank you, Melissa. Very, very concerned constituents, as well as, you know, just people in the community. They're very concerned about tens of thousands of people from around the country descending here on Jacksonville for the RNC. We've had a spike, as you just reported, in cases here in the state of Florida, but also right here here in Jacksonville. I received a call over the weekend from a local business owner that his employees, the restaurant employee, tested positive. Now he's shutting down. He shut down his business, and now everyone is being tested. So it is a crisis, and it's continuing to spread. And so people are worried, and it's not a time to gaslight and not speak on the facts.
Why did you accuse the mayor of gaslighting?
You know, as I was reading Twitter, questions were asked about the uptick, and he basically downplayed the increase. When he first started reporting, he did a great job. He was talking about the percent positive. You know, the percent positive here in Duval County is low. The percent positive is 2%. 2% percent positive. We've flattened the curve, but now the percent positive is 14%, and now the narrative has changed. Well, now it's hospitalizations. We don't care about the percent positive. We care about the hospitalization, and that's gaslighting. Let's not change, the narrative. Let's not change, the numbers, or use the numbers that best benefit you know, the message that I'm trying to convey. And so, like I said before, it was percent positive. It's going from 2% to 14%, but we're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about hospitalizations. And I think that's wrong. I think that's giving Jacksonville, the community, a false sense of security.
The mayor tweeted a series of tweets about this last night. He called out the media as well, saying that the media is the voice to the public. They control what people hear and see. Reporting rising cases is fair and accurate. Suggesting people are sick and in the ICU is not. New York went through hell and media celebrated the response. Well, we certainly didn't celebrate it here, I will say that. The mayor goes on to say, we work our butts off with data and experts to not experience that hell. Nothing is certain, but media has a responsibility to be accurate and balanced about what is happening on the ground. And so what he seems to be saying is that he believes some media outlets are overhyping the concerns about coronavirus in our area.
It's not true. Listen, unless someone... You know, in your house, somebody close to you, if they get infected, someone passes away, you have a different sense of awareness about it. And I think until it hits home, you're going to continue to put those false narratives out there. And I think it's wrong for the city of Jacksonville. You know, we're leaders. We're supposed to give accurate information, not give information to suit your agenda. I continue to say that, you know, that is wrong and irresponsible.
And you've also been critical of the Republican National Convention being held here in Jacksonville in August. What about, though, what we've heard from local officials, that they will encourage the use of masks and social distancing at ViStar Veterans Arena when the president comes here? We did not see a whole lot of that the other night in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at his rally there, although we saw some. But we are hearing from officials here that there will be temperature checks and people will be encouraged to mask up. Your thoughts?
You know, there's a report just came out where there is nothing in writing. There's no public record on any health guidelines, you know, what the city is obligated, you know, financially to pay. None of that. So until I see it in writing in a contract, I am very leery of you know, of officials just reporting, you know, verbally. I like to see something in writing. It's our responsibility to make sure that, you know, if it's coming here, that, you know, that you know, that the citizens here in Jacksonville are safe and secure, and we do not continue to spread COVID-19. Or expose our residents.
We're speaking with City Councilman Garrett Dennis. We'll go to your calls in a moment. 549-2937. There is something in writing I want to ask you about. It's from Council Auditor Kyle Billy, an email he sent about additional CARES Act funding received by the City of Jacksonville. About $159 million of CARES Act federal funds sent to this community to help alleviate all of the effects of the coronavirus and the recession. The council auditor apparently found a discrepancy that the city actually received $167 million, an additional $8 million and change, and that money is available for appropriation by the city council for allowable uses per the CARES Act. How will that additional $8 million be used?
It's interesting. We just received that on late Friday night, that email. I received the same email. And so we have council meeting on Tuesday to determine how to get that money out to the citizens of Jacksonville. I think that CARES Act money needs to be deployed to the citizens of Jacksonville. It's their money, whether it's in rent relief, whether it's in you know, utility relief, or whether that's a stimulus check to the citizens of Jacksonville. That's their money, and we need to get it out because there are people that are hurting here in our city financially because of the pandemic. But let me say this. You know, what was remarkable about that, the city of Jacksonville received that additional $8 million back in April, and our council auditor kept asking about the money, and was given the runaround, and they had to call the feds directly to find out about the dollars. And once they discovered, the administration then came clean that we got that we received an additional $8 million. Somebody needs to be held accountable for that, whether overlooking the bank statements or concealing $8 million of the people's money. And so I think somebody needs to step up.
You think someone did something? Are you accusing anyone in the administration of hiding those funds, doing something that's not above board with them?
One of two things happened. Either someone dropped the ball and didn't do their job when we received $8 million back in April, the people's money, or someone intentionally did not share it with the city council. So one of two things happened. Either someone dropped the ball, they didn't do their job, and lost $8 million, or someone was trying to hide $8 million. One or two, but both are irresponsible.
We're speaking with Garrett Dennis. Calls in a moment, 549-2937. And let me ask you now, Councilman, about the bill you filed. It would change the name of Heming Park to be named after civil rights leader and star of the Harlem Renaissance, James Weldon Johnson, who wrote what is known as the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. He hailed from Jacksonville, had many accomplishments in his lifetime. You filed this legislation on the heels of the mayor taking down the statue of the Confederate soldier in Heming Park. Why, in your view, is it important to change the name of the park as well?
Well, first of all, I want to give, the mayor kudos for removing the statue. And so following his lead of removing the statue, I introduced that bill to rename it. It's time to turn a new chapter in our city's history. And at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that Charles Heming donated the statue. And after donating the statue, the city changed the name to the park in honor of him. Now that the statue has been removed, now it's time to in that same vein, change the name of the park. Like I said before, how fitting for, in my opinion, the most prominent person who was born and raised in Jacksonville, for that park, the center of our city, to be named after.
Do you think there will be majority support for this on the city council?
Currently, I have three co-sponsors. Councilman Carlucci, and I must say he's a white Republican, Terrence Freeman, he's a black Republican, and Rory Diamond, who's a white Republican. And the reason why I share that, because it's not a political thing, it's not a race thing, it's about the right thing to do to rename that park and turn a new chapter in our city's history.
Let's go to some calls now, jammed lines, as we discuss a series of hot topics this morning on a Monday with Councilman Garrett Dennis. Chris in Jacksonville. Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Chris. I have worked with Take 'Em Down Jacks in the community for the past 4 years. I just want to put out there that I totally agree with, first off, the Confederate monument coming down. I don't agree with how he did it, but I'm not going to give him credit for it, though I am glad it is gone. I would also like to say thanks to Garrett Dennis, who always pushing the status quo. Appreciate you having the back of the back black and brown people in the community. We need you here. But I think it's a great idea to have a black and brown council get together to make this happen on the terms of the black people in the community. I'm so tired of the white people in the community making the decisions. So it's very nice to see Garrett Dennis being the trailblazer of this. It is just the most refreshing thing I have heard in a while. I'm not going to sit here and pat your back because I haven't seen anything happen yet, but I appreciate you standing up and saying these words, because people like me, white women in the community, it is not our place to be leading anything coming to race relations, but we are here to support. So anything you need, you just ask on the activists, and we will try our hardest to have your back. But please, do us proud in the community, and just keep pushing, man. Just keep pushing for this.
Chris, thanks. Councilman Dennis, in the recent weeks, we have seen enormous protests across the country, including here in Jacksonville, and they are multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-generational, but they're leading with the sentiment that caller Chris just mentioned, that white people coming out to protest are simply there as allies and that they're not in charge, and that these conversations need to be led by people of color.
I don't disagree, and Chris, thank you for your comments. You know, brown, African American, Hispanic, this whole movement is going to take all of us. You know, white, black, browns. You know, it's going to take the rainbow. And so, I really appreciate you know, all of Chris's comments, but it's going to take all of us. And so, I do believe that. That the protests and the marches, they bring awareness, but now it's time to, as far as the council, we need to start enacting legislation. And, you know, right after the march, I not only introduced this bill to rename the park, but also introduced several bills, one to add another public comment because people want their voices to be heard, add another public comment section back in the council. Also to mandate 20% on every contract that comes from the city of Jacksonville, 20% for small and emerging businesses. Jacksonville, Duval County, City of Jacksonville procures $300 million in goods and services each and every year with no mandate. And adding a 20% mandate on every contract for small and emerging businesses, that's $60 million direct impact to small and emerging businesses. That's going to be a game changer here in our community. So you're absolutely right. You know, it's going to take not just me, but, you know, nine other people to support the various bills that I've introduced to change, you know, what's going on or what has gone on in our city and in our country as a whole.
You've introduced lots of bills in your time on the council. That said, getting a lot of this stuff through needs coalitions. Do you have the skills to build the coalitions on the city council to shepherd some of these changes through? What would you say to critics of your time on the council that you've served mainly as a foil to the mayor rather than working in conjunction with your colleagues on the council to enact real policy change? And I'm not speaking for myself, but for those who've criticized you.
Yeah. So that's a very good question. And so the biggest opposition to the bills that I've introduced hasn't come from within the council. It's come from the mayor's office. And make no mistake about it, you know, when I introduced a bill to fund a outside attorney to look into the sale of JDA, it's $1.8 million. The opposition came from the mayor's office trying to whip vote to vote against it. It passed. Just recently, to reappropriate $5 million in the CARES Act that was going to developers and builders in the construction community, to reappropriate that $5 million and put that back into or send that to the community, for rent relief and utility relief, that was fought by the administration, not the city council. So again, you know, as we move forward, I do think people are waking up to the administration gaslighting and not wanting progress. The decriminalization of marijuana, which failed, and you know, I plan on reintroducing it again in the fall. You know, again, I could just go, you know, bill after bill after bill after bill. And I've realized that it's not the message, it's the messenger. And so, you know, moving forward, you know, the coalition and the approach has changed, but I think people are waking up and seeing who's really the stumbling block for progress and change in in our city and in our community.
And as we talk about all of these issues, lots of calls for Councilman Garrett Dennis. By the way, I don't want to leave St. Augustine out. City commissioners down there today are going to decide the fate of a Confederate monument in downtown St. Augustine. They'll be meeting on that today, and we will be following that as well. Let's go to Charles on the west side. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, good morning, Melissa. I am an Army brat, and I was shocked when I came to Jacksonville from Germany to Forest High School, and I never really felt comfortable with that name there, so I'm glad that got changed. And I support Councilman Dennis. I would ask him to consider perhaps Jake Godbold Park as a new name for Hemming.
Thank you for that. I'm sure there'll be no shortage of suggestions, Councilman. I'm sure you've gotten quite a few.
I've gotten quite a few. You know, Jake, you know, he was definitely definitely a mentor to me. But I think it's all about, and I'll, you know, be honest with you, it's raising and bringing the awareness of a prominent African-American that for the past 149 years, he has been vetted. He is world-renowned, and I don't think in 100 years we'll look back and be disappointed.
That begs another point. I want to read this from our Facebook page. Perry writes, a few years ago, St. John's County Public Schools said any new schools would not be named after people at all. At first, I didn't like the idea, but I have since come to embrace it. No human being is perfect. Better to just name things after ideals, such as Freedom Plaza. What do you think of that argument?
Sounds good. Currently, we do not have that restriction here in Jacksonville, and so I stand behind James Weldon Johnson. I never said he was perfect, but he's been vetted, and he's someone that, again, in 100 years, we will still be proud of. We have a school named after him. We have a YMCA named after him. It's to raise awareness of a prominent African-American who was born and raised right here in Jacksonville.
Keith in Riverside. Hi, Keith. Thanks for holding. Happy Monday.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy Monday. I'm really happy to see all these monuments to white supremacy and the Confederacy coming down. My interest is in the military. There's an article that I wrote being published today about removing the name of the USS John C. Stennis from an aircraft carrier. John Stennis was a prosecutor in Mississippi in 1935 who tried to execute three black men whose confessions had been obtained by torture. And now we have, you know, 85 years after that, we have a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier named after him. So the military is right to start removing these symbols, and Naval Institute Press will be publishing that article sometime this morning. And I think the American people need to know that white supremacy is being supported by our tax dollars on military bases and on U.S. naval warships, and that needs to end.
Thank you, Keith. That includes Fort Benning up in Georgia, Councilman Dennis. The military has come forth in the last week or so and said the names of all these installations are going to be changed over the next few years.
Yeah, it's going to take a wide range of jurisdictions and various entities to make those changes. I'm a city council member. My jurisdiction is, you know, it's the city of Jacksonville, and, you know, my last 3 years here on the council, I'm going to do my part to try to level the playing field and try to, right some of the wrongs consolidation, of discrimination. I mean, that's my plan. That's my goal. That's my mission for the next 3 years. I'm on the council.
Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark.
Hello, good morning. You know, I would like to ask the city councilman to stop doing half measures and to really get his name out there because, you know, Hemming Park and Confederate Point and all that stuff, those are small potatoes. I want to see him stand up and push for a name change to the entire city of Jacksonville, because as we all know, Andrew Jackson was the president, and during his lifetime, he owned between 300 and 500 slaves. So what better person that needs a name change in the entire city? I dare
and
him
do you
to do that.
And do you mean that, or are you kind of making a joke? Are you serious? Ah, he hung up. Whether he was being sarcastic or not, let me ask you about that, Councilman Dennis, because, you know, this city is named after a guy who owned slaves, who was responsible for the Trail of Tears, you know, the Native American genocide. He wasn't a good guy. So for people who don't necessarily agree with tearing down monuments to white supremacy and the Confederacy, They'll make examples like that to say, well, where does this end? Both Washington and Jefferson, the founders of this country, owned slaves, and they're on the face of Mount Rushmore. Slavery and white supremacy was woven into the very founding fabric of our country. And so that's what makes this so difficult, and that's why it's taken so long. What are your thoughts about Mark's point there, about the name of this very town, Jacksonville?
He makes a great point, but I think, you know, one step at a time. I mean, we're dealing with the Confederacy. Andrew Jackson, he was, you know, long gone before the Civil War and the Confederacy and start hanging out of the various monuments. And we know exactly the reason why the monuments were put up. It was to strike fear and to, you know, to keep, you know, blacks in their place. I mean, you know, Charles Henning donated the statue back in the late 1800s, years past from the Civil War. Why was that donated? The Confederacy only lasted less than 5 years. But, you know, why is it that we're putting up all these statues and naming all of these, you know, buildings and schools after the Confederacy, who lost the war? And I don't want to get too far in it because, you know, I know we have a lot of stuff to cover, you know, but, you know, why should we reward, the Confederacy for fighting the United States? And their reason for fighting the United States were to keep black people enslaved. So all these markers going to, you know, to the Confederacy that lost the war. So again, this is the start, but that's, you know, that's definitely open for another conversation later.
And we were talking earlier about the spread of COVID-19 in this community. Here's a tweet for you from a listener. The councilman just cited 14% COVID rates. Where is he getting that number? It differs wildly from the Florida dashboard. Are we really at 14% positive in Duval, Northeast Florida right now for COVID?
If they look at the numbers, if they look at the numbers from when we were closed until now, it's not 14%, right at 14%. But we're not talking about the percent positive. What we're talking about now is hospitalization. Why? Because we want to change the narrative that it's not that bad. It's nothing to see here. And it's wrong. It's irresponsible. We need to be forthcoming with the data to let people know that this is a serious pandemic and we need to fight it on every front we can.
Do you think that we should have a mandate to wear masks in Jacksonville as other Florida cities have done?
I think we need to. I think there needs to be a mandate to wear masks here in Jacksonville. Absolutely.
And we have not seen any indication that the mayor will call for that, although he has modeled mask wearing and he's encouraged everyone to wear a mask. He has encouraged it without going so far as to require it.
Right. And I think it leads up to the RNC. I don't have any data. Again, the whole process of the RNC coming to Jacksonville has been cloaked in secrecy. So I truly believe that it's because of the RNC, and probably after the RNC, there will be a mandate to wear it. It's unfortunate, and it's putting a lot of our citizens here in Jacksonville at risk.
And when you say cloaked in secrecy, you mean a lack of a paper trail on looking at how the event was put together for this city?
Yes. There's no transparency. There's no paper trail. a major event that will cost millions of dollars, and to say that, you know, no city resources will be used. That's not true, because our JSO will be on the front lines. Who pays the salary and benefits of our officers? We do, taxpayers. So to say that no city resources will be used for this event is just not true. And it's all about, you know, just being open and honest and transparent with the community, with the city, instead of, you know, trying not to, and then we find out after. Just be open and honest and let us know what our responsibility is, and let us dig down and be a part of it, and not be, you know, in the blind. You know, one of the things that, you know, former Mayor Jake Godbold used to say all the time is that, listen, no one wants to get on the plane after it's taken off. You know, everyone wants to be on the plane when it takes off, not after, you know, the plane after it's 10,000 feet in the air. And so that's all I'm asking.
All right. And as we talked about these intertwined stories this morning, COVID, the RNC, the monuments to the Confederacy, I appreciate your time. He's City Councilman Garrett Dennis. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And much more still ahead on the show later this hour.
I work all around the world, and when I go to these places, I encounter these interesting foods.
First Coast author and food consultant Jeffrey Speer, a look inside his new book, My Life in Gluttony. But up next, what diversity and inclusion will look like on local campuses. We'll be right back.
Northeast Florida has its fingerprints all over the history of popular music, and contemporary local artists are making music that's reverberating across the country. But I've found, even with apps putting millions of songs into our pockets, it's hard to discover local music.
Can I get y'all to just bob your heads?
I'm Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw, and that's why I'm hosting the Voidcast, produced by WJCT. You'll hear from local artists and the people who lived local music history. WJCT.org/Voidcast. Before you leave.
Electro Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
Hi, this is David McGowan, CEO here at WJCT, and I'd like to say thank you to all of you who helped us meet our goal during our fundraising drive last week. We are here for you, and you were there for us. Thank you.
Welcome back. In the wake of the killing of George Floyd, protesters around the world have been calling for police reform and racial justice, and organizations of all types are doing what they can to meet the moment. Parvez Ahmed is the new director of diversity and inclusion and also professor of finance at the Coggin College of Business at UNF. I spoke with him about what's happening on campus to respond to the calls for more diversity. Let's listen. Parvez Ahmed, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Melissa, too.
So tell us what the Coggin College of Business is doing at UNF to better reflect the importance of diversity and inclusion on campus.
So our efforts in trying to improve diversity and inclusion on campus actually started before we had the unfortunate tragedies of George Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor. I was appointed as the Director of Diversity and Inclusion in January, and I started to do my work working with the university to come up with a strategic plan for diversity and inclusion for the entire campus, but also at the college level, organizing conversations between students and with faculty and staff in trying to address this current crisis that we are in, and how can academia be of value at this moment in time when we are facing this specter of not only police brutality, but over 400 years of systemic oppression. What can academia do to change the status quo?
And you're planning to do some things, including a Real Talk series for open forums at UNF. How will those work?
At UNF, we have a commission called the Commission on Diversity and Inclusion. And through that commission, we have put together a series of talks. We call it the Real Talk series, where we are having conversations with our students and then separately with faculty and staff to first give everybody a space to express their thoughts, their aspirations, their anxieties, their fears. But then from through that talk, come up with more substantive actions that can, again, change the status quo. Because the idea of talk and conversation, we are way past that. Right now, what we are looking for is ways in which we change what the current situation is. And while any one of us as individuals may have a very small impact on changing the national discourse or even the city's discourse, but each one of us on campus at different levels, myself as a faculty, I do have some ability to impact the conversation with my students, with my colleagues, and through that come up with policies and procedures and programs, hiring practices that can change the situation that we find ourselves in. At UNF, you can see this pretty in pretty stark terms. At UNF, our student population that is African American is way below the city's average. It is also way below the national average. So obviously on campus, we are not as diverse as we need to be. And part of the problem that we are not as diverse stems from the fact that our faculty ranks are not as diverse as we need to be. Because to attract students who are minorities, people of color, underrepresented minorities, you must have a faculty body, an administration body that also reflects those values. So we are not where we need to be, but the good news is that we are making efforts towards that end.
And what are you hearing from students and faculty about these efforts? What are their biggest concerns?
At one level, everybody feels hopeful because you see a multicultural, a multiracial coalition on the streets advocating for change, and that is significant. That's a significant change from where we have been in the past. But at the same time, people who are perhaps a little bit older, like I am, also feel a sense of skepticism. And the question that I keep on asking is, are we in a moment or are we in the middle of a movement? Because if it is a moment, then this moment will pass. And like other challenges that we have faced before, they came and gone without the social changes in place that were necessary to address those crises to begin with. The examples that I keep coming up with is Parkland and Sandy Hook. After those two tragedies, there was a groundswell of uprising and angst among people that we needed to change the status quo with guns, but very little changed. We maybe have tinkered around the margins, but not substantive changes. So that's the fear. If it is a movement, then this movement will be sustainable. Then there will be changes made at all levels, at the university level, at the city level, at the state level, at the federal level, and eventually at the global level. But where we are is still an open question in my mind. I would like to think this is a movement, but I also have fears that this could also be another one of those passing moments.
In order to ensure that it isn't just a passing moment, are you setting concrete goals at UNF in terms of the percentage of faculty of color and students in order to ensure a more diverse population on the campus?
UNF just appointed Whitney Meyer as our first vice president of diversity, and I think that's a step in the right direction, that we now have a person with that rank, a person with diversity as their portfolio at the level of a vice president. My appointment as the director of diversity and inclusion at the Coggin College of Business is also a step in the right direction because it's a position that is advocating for diversity and inclusion. I sit on the executive committee of the College of Business. So there are spaces and seats around the table where our voice was lacking. Now we have people with those voices making those advocacy. But these are, in my view, just the first step in a very, very long journey. And the goal has to be that the university's population begins to reflect the population of the region that we serve. At this moment in time, we are nowhere close to that. We have a long way to go. But there is commitment. There are conversations happening with enrollment services, with the provost, with the president, with the deans, that I think everybody is trying to come up with ways in which we can change so that we can reflect the population that we are serving.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing all this with us. He's Dr. Parvez Ahmed, the new Director of Diversity and Inclusion and Professor of Finance at the Coggin College of Business at UNF. Parvez, thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And here's something else I want to share with all of you right now. Yes, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. Yes, we're in the middle of a recession. And there is a lot of bad news every single day. We've seen people hospitalized and dying of COVID. We've seen businesses close, people lose their jobs, people worried about rent relief, how they're going to feed their kids, how they're going to pay their bills. There is so much happening now that is heavy, serious, and it's real. And we're going to continue to cover it every day here at WJCT and on this program. All of that said, at the same time, in the midst of these tough times, there is a lot of good that's happening around town, too, in our world. There are so many examples of people reaching out and trying to help each other through these times, trying to do what good they can in this pandemic and in this recession. This is a giving community, and it's full of great people. And so we here at First Coast Connect are going to be spotlighting that with a brand new free e-newsletter. It's called What's Good Wednesdays. And beginning this Wednesday, we're going to send it out to anyone who subscribes with fresh, sparkling midweek rambles and updates from me and First Coast Connect producer Heather Schatz, where we bring you up to date on what's going on across this community and give you a few little peeks behind our curtain, too. And so if this interests you, if you care to add one more thing to your inbox each week, I want you to sign up for What's Good Wednesdays. Just go to WJCT.org, look to the right side of the page, and click on What's Good Wednesdays, the sign-up form. It only takes a second, and then we have a whole new way of communicating with you about some positive news that's happening all across this community. Again, What's Good Wednesdays, sign up today at WJCT.org. And if you've got something good going on in your life that you want us to add to our weekly menu, just send us an email with all the news that's fit to print. Send it to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, and we will consider it to add in What's Good Wednesdays. Again, the first one goes out this Wednesday. A quick break, and in a moment, food consultant and author Jeff Speer on his new book, capturing his foodie adventures all around the world. We'll talk to him about my life in gluttony. That's next.
In 1960, 18-year-old college freshman Joan Mulholland became very active in the civil rights movement. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Joan Mulholland. We'll discuss Florida Businesswoman Magazine and visit Matheson History Museum in Gainesville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
After Ferguson, President Obama put together a panel to rethink policing in America. 5 years and many police shootings later, one of its members still thinks reform is possible.
You can't fix a problem if you don't acknowledge that it exists, but it doesn't mean that you need to just give up and blow the whole thing up.
How much did it actually achieve? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The administrator of the Panama Canal has a front row seat to global trade in the midst of the pandemic. He says traffic is down significantly, but also because of climate change, the canal is running low on water.
We were at the lowest level to start a dry season, probably in the last 20 years, 25 years.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Should we expect more surprises from the Supreme Court? The justices aren't done yet, with many still reeling over recent decisions on Dreamers and rights for LGBTQ workers. Up next, the president's tax returns, rules on abortion, and the role of the Electoral College. Oye, oye, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. First Coast author, food consultant, and local raconteur Jeffrey Speer has traveled the world in search of a great meal. And he's captured all his foodie adventures in a great new book. It's called My Life in Gluttony. Let's listen.
Jeff Speer, good to talk to you.
Likewise. Thanks for chatting with me.
The title of your new book is irresistible. My Life in Gluttony. So let's begin there. Tell me about the title of this book.
Well, folks that know me know that I'm not a small guy. And I've always enjoyed eating. My mom was a very good cook. I think she started the whole infatuation with food because I had so much good stuff at home. In my professional life, I work all around the world, mostly in countries that are considered emerging economies, which tend to be some of the more obscure, out-of-the-way, and poorest countries on the planet. And when I go to these places, I encounter these interesting foods. There are ingredients and there are recipes that we just don't see over here. And my friends were always saying, hey, why don't you publish some of the recipes? And so I realized that, you know, throughout my life, every place that I've lived, there've always been foods and culinary experiences that really stood out. In fact, you know, when I was writing the book, I realized that when I was in Italy, and I was probably about 20 years old at the time, I don't remember the people I met. I don't remember the actual places that I went to or the geography of the places, but I remember the foods I ate crystal clear.
Sure. So what destinations will we see in this book? We can really travel all around the world just by reading your book.
There are 19 chapters in the book. Each one is a destination. I start out with Maryland. I mean, and this covers the gamut of my culinary experiences, all the things that stood out. It's not a travel log on these different places, but it's what were the foods that I encountered that really made an impression. And so it starts in Maryland, which is where I grew up. I went to school in Tucson. That's where I learned about Mexican food and tequila. Mm. Many trips to New York, so having hot dogs on the corner and going to the Festival of San Gennaro, which is where I encountered my very first Italian sausage. Going to Paris and having crepes on the street. In Italy, when I went to Italy, nobody talked about pasta. That word wasn't in the vocabulary. We talked about spaghetti, or we talked about Chef Boyardee, you know? And I went to Italy, and all of a sudden I found this thing called tortellini. Well, tortellini had become one of my favorite pastas of all time. So in Italy, and in London, there were scotch eggs and, Cornish pasties, which I had never had. I lived in L.A., so there are things that happen there. There's Hawaii, Australia. Australia, I spent a lot of time in. And so my favorite food from Australia is Moreton Bay bugs, which are a variety of, what do they call it, slipper lobster.
Not bugs.
Bay bugs. They call them bugs, but it's a slipper lobster.
And okay.
They're far better than lobster. than what we know as Maine lobster.
So just an incredible amount of food you've enjoyed. But I have to ask you, you've traveled the world, but what's your favorite food here in Jacksonville?
Well, see, when I moved to Jacksonville, I realized that I didn't know what I was getting into exactly from a culinary perspective, but the whole Southern cuisine fascinated me. So, you know, there was macaroni and cheese and shrimp and grits and biscuits and gravy. And, you know, certainly you go over to Louisiana and the whole Cajun Creole impact over there. But in Jacksonville in particular, mac and cheese and barbecue were the two standouts. You know, the barbecue here is phenomenal. I've got a couple of favorite places. I also learned about better rum here. I spent a lot of time in Dos Gatos. And the bar manager there, Casey, he's when I go in, he takes a little bit of time and he walks me through his bar. And so I've learned about a lot about rum and a lot about gin from him. But I'd say, and mac and cheese is one of my favorite food groups.
Hey, sure, me too. Yeah, you can't go wrong there. Well, I'm hungry just thinking about all of this food. And this is such a great book from a great author and a food expert. He is just a culinary expert that we are delighted to have on the show regularly, Jacksonville's own Jeff Speer, and his new title is My Life in Gluttony. You can get it on Amazon, and hopefully at some point when social distancing is over, we can see you at a book signing or two.
Yeah, I'm hoping for that, too. We're actually planning a dinner where one chefs in town is going to cook some of my recipes, and we'll talk about the book. It'll be a lot of fun, but we want to make sure that we can get people in the house, so we're holding off.
We'll look forward to that at some point. Thank you so much, Jeff. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Melissa. Yeah, it's great talking to you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. WGCT's news director is the great Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortzfeld keeps those stories pumping out on WJCT.org each and every day. Keep those emails coming, meanwhile, to us at firstcoastconnect@WJCT.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock here on the radio or online, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday and wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.